Representative John Boehner is out on the races on for the next Speaker of the House. It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics with 538's Harry Enten.
Also coming up, the first Democratic primary debate of this cycle is scheduled for Tuesday. 20 million Americans tuned into the first Republican debates with a much smaller field for the Dems and no Donald Trump. What's the turnout going to look like? And will Vice President Joe Biden jump into the race by then?
And Gallup has announced that after being pretty far off the mark during the last presidential election, the polling group is not going to conduct polls for the primary and may not even tackle the general election.
Harry Enten is with us now. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with the effort to replace John Boehner. Give us the cast of characters. Who's out there in the running?
So basically, there's one main character in Kevin McCarthy, who's a representative out in California, who's the majority leader. And then there are two smaller fish, Jason Chaffetz, who is a representative from Utah, and Daniel Webster, who is a representative from Florida. But the main character here is Kevin McCarthy, who, despite some missteps over the last week, is still heavily favored to be the next Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Tell us a little bit about McCarthy before we go into the political maneuvering to get him in there.
Yeah, so Kevin McCarthy would be the youngest speaker, I think, since 1891. He's the one who had the least experience. He only became a member of the House in the mid-2000s. He's worked his way up the aisle. He's someone who has fundraised a lot for the Republican caucus, which neither Chaffetz nor Webster have done. He was able to rise up to majority leader. And what's perhaps most interesting about him is his record is actually slightly to the left of John Boehner's, which might not make a lot of sense to people, given that Boehner was driven out by some Tea Party members.
The tricky bit here is if all Republicans voted for him, he'd win, no problem, a majority. If he wins a majority of Republicans, though, that's not enough because he needs a majority of the whole chamber to get elected. So maybe the Democrats have some say in this.
So it's very interesting. They'll hold a private caucus vote, the Republicans, behind closed doors, which McCarthy is easily expected to win. But when they have the actual speaker vote later on this month after Boehner steps down, there is a question about whether or not McCarthy can get to those 218 votes to become the next Speaker of the House. We don't know, but what seems will probably happen is, knowing that there are these factions out there in the Republican Party who could deny him that majority out in front of the whole House, they'll try and extract different pieces, you know, things from him, which those eventually are, we can't say, but they'll try and extract things from him in exchange for assuring that he ascends to Speaker of the House.
And these Republican factions, you said, generally considered more conservative, the people who wanted Boehner out want a more conservative Speaker?
Right. They want a more conservative speaker, the House Freedom Caucus. They want a more conservative speaker. They want someone who's going to challenge President Obama, get more in his face. But more than that, I think they also just want to be respected. Remember, I think everybody who's in Washington, for the most part, is somebody who's smart, even if the other side of the aisle doesn't believe that they're smart. They understand what politics is all about, but they want their voices to be heard. They want to be given credit, say, okay, you're going to speak with me. You'll hear out my concerns. Even if what I say can't exactly happen because of the way politics works, you'll at least wink at me and recognize that I'm here and that I represent some faction of the American people, which is something that I think they felt Boehner really didn't do. Boehner kind of shut them out.
Is there any kind of overlap between the presidential race, the Republican primary, and this effort for the speaker? Are the candidates taking a stake in this?
I mean, I think most of them at this point are kind of, it hasn't really come up too much. I mean, McCarthy is just such a heavy favorite at this point. But where this has come up and has become a big deal is McCarthy said, I believe it was last week, that the Benghazi hearings were an effort by Republicans that they were able to bring down Hillary Clinton, bring her back down to earth, and it politicized those hearings. And once that became politicized, Hillary Clinton was able to use McCarthy in an ad and say, look, the Republicans are out to get me. So in that way, it became heavily politicized and became part of the presidential race overnight.
Well, let's stay on that Democratic side of the presidential race. First debate scheduled for Tuesday, different from the Republican debates, a lot fewer candidates for one thing. Are people going to watch this one like they did those Republican ones, which people watch partly because of Donald Trump?
Maybe they'll put it on in the background to help them fall asleep. I mean, it's just not going to be as exciting. There's no Donald Trump. The cast of characters on the Democratic side, I think Bernie Sanders is an interesting fella, but folks like Martin O'Malley, a former governor of Maryland, Jim Webb, a former senator from Virginia, Lincoln Chafee, a former Republican senator from Rhode Island and an independent governor, these people are just not that thrilling. I mean, there's just not a lot there, and there's not 10 people on stage. There's going to be, you know, about half a dozen or a little bit less. I'm going to watch it because it's my job, but I think a lot of other people might watch baseball instead. I know I would if it wasn't my job.
We're talking to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, about the latest in national politics. More on that debate and the Democratic presidential field coming up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a Republican you'd like to see replace John Boehner? What kind of questions do you want to hear Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders answer in the first Democratic primary debate? Would you like to see Joe Biden on that stage? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, about the latest in national politics, things like John Boehner stepping down as speaker and the coming Democratic primary debate.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. What kinds of questions do you want to hear answered in the Democratic debate? As polling group Gallup announces it isn't going to conduct polling for the primary elections, tell us what extent you trust poll numbers or if they mean anything to you at all. Call 800-642-1234.
Go right to a caller. Alex is on the line with us in Milwaukee. Alex, hi.
Hello. I just have a comment to your guest. You know, he was talking about how he's not even doesn't even want to watch the debate. You know, it's just appalling to me when people talk like that, especially people in broadcasting. The apathy is just ridiculous. He endorses the zoo that is the Republican primary, and he acts like there's nothing exciting about what's going on in the Democratic primary right now. I mean, Bernie Sanders just had 20,000 people in Boston, and it's like unheard of the amount of people he's having. And that was only the third largest gathering for him. If there's anything to watch for, it's for Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's reigniting, you know, the populace. And
Alex, thanks a lot for the call. Harry, he's not excited about the zoo-style excitement, he calls it, for the Republican debate, excited about Bernie Sanders. Is there some excitement in this debate after all?
I mean, look, to me, if you, I go to candidates' websites, I read their policy positions, I hear their speeches. If you want to get a 20-second soundbite or a minute soundbite from these different candidates, then you can watch that debate. But me personally, I believe that a voter, if they want to figure out what a candidate truly stands for, they listen to their speeches and they go to their websites. They shouldn't just watch a debate in which a moderator is able to control what the candidates say and don't say. As for the crowd sizes, yes, Bernie Sanders has gotten very large crowd sizes, but crowd sizes don't correlate to actual election results. If they did, then Mitt Romney would have won the state of Pennsylvania and probably would have won the presidency. I tend to look at polling data, which is certainly not perfect, but to me, at least history tells us, is much more highly correlated with the actual result of the election.
Alex, thanks for the call. We'll get to some polling news in a moment, but let's talk about Vice President Joe Biden, whether he's going to run. A lot of writing has happened on this topic. I'll sum it all up. We don't know. Maybe Joe Biden does. Maybe he doesn't at this point. But you wrote a piece saying getting into a race late doesn't pay off necessarily for candidates, Harry.
Yeah, so what I essentially did was I looked at late entrances going back to 1980, and what we saw was that their polling really didn't bounce up that much frequently. The one exception to that was Rick Perry, who then slid back down after a few poor debate performances. That's not good news for Joe Biden, because at this point, despite all of the press talking about him, he's still in third place nationally in Iowa and New Hampshire behind both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. So he needs to do better in the actual results than he's doing in the polling right now. And historically, that just hasn't been the case. Usually these late entrances don't tend to outperform their polling, at least at this point.
One case you compared it to was Senator Fred Thompson, a Republican. I can't remember, what was that, 2000?
It was 2008.
2008, right. People were waiting and waiting and hoping to get into the race. And maybe he's a comparable position to Joe Biden, respected longtime leader within the party. Some lessons there for Joe Biden?
Yeah, so this is, you know, Thompson, kind of like Biden, was sort of running this backwards campaign. I'd say Thompson, we had a better idea that Thompson was actually going to run than Biden. But here he was as this sort of establishment backstop, which is what Joe Biden is. He's not someone who lights up the left wing of the party like Bernie Sanders does. But he is somebody who can step in and sort of coalesce all these different parts of the Democratic Party, as Thompson was able to do the Republican Party. And then Thompson entered the race. He was sort of polling in the high teens like Biden is right now. And then Thompson went nowhere. He sort of peaked out in the low 20s and then fell back the further he's gone into the campaign. And that, to me, is a very troubling sort of example for Biden, because he shares, of all the late entrances, probably the most in common with Thompson than any of the other ones I mentioned in my article.
Now let's get into polling a little bit there at 538. You are big poll watchers, and you're going to have one less major poll to watch. Gallup said, hey, we're not going to track numbers in the primaries, maybe not even the general election. Gallup, huge name in polling in general, presidential elections in particular. What's going on?
So, look, Gallup is a large polling organization. They have a long track record going back to 1936. But after their poor polling in 2010 and 2012, and they ran some experiments, they have decided, they will say, and they do say, that those poor 2012 and 2010 results didn't affect their decision today, that they're going to, in fact, focus on the issues. They feel that there are a lot of other pollsters who will focus on the horse race, and indeed there are a lot of other pollsters who will focus on the horse race. All of the major networks over the last month have put out a primary poll. So, yes, Gallup is gone. It's a big name. But there are other ones who are still carrying the mantle. So, you know, yes, it's one less poll, but it's not something that means the end of days. We'll still have polling to pour over, perhaps a little too much polling, if anything.
And those issue ones from Gallup, still looking forward to seeing those over the course of the race?
Sure, of course. I mean, we're always interested not only in who's winning, but why candidates are winning. And, you know, I think Bernie Sanders is an excellent example where, even though he's not willing, he's clearly climbed the polls past where many analysts, including myself, thought he would eventually be. And the types of polls that Gallup can put together, in which they ask voters, why are you voting for so-and-so, what are the important issues, that can help us sort of put the race into an actual framework of what's going on and what the American people are thinking.
And very briefly, a weird thing in Donald Trump's polling. It matters if a person being polled is talking to a live human. Tell us
yes.
about that.
So what essentially it is, Donald Trump does better in polls in which no human is actually talking, which may indicate that there's a hidden Donald Trump vote that people are afraid to tell pollsters that they would actually want to support Trump. We'll see if that continues on. It is right now. But if it does, then maybe Donald Trump will actually do better than a lot of people, including myself, think.
Something to talk about next week. Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.
Nearly 4,000 acres of sand dunes, wetlands, and prairie in Wisconsin and Illinois recently received a major global distinction. The Shewaukee Prairie Illinois Beach Lake Plain has been designated as a wetland of international importance under the Ramsar Convention, becoming only the 38th such place in the United States.
Shewaukee Prairie is in good company. We're talking places like Everglades National Park and the Door Peninsula Coastal West Wetlands are on that list. But what does this designation mean? How could it affect conservation going forward?
Here with us now to answer those questions and tell us more about the Shewaukee Prairie area is Steve Richter, Director of Conservation Programs for the Nature Conservancy. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on, Veronica.
So let's start with the Wetland of International Importance designation. What does that mean?
Well, it's a great honor for the state of Wisconsin to know that our state has five such designated wetlands in our state, Shewaukee Prairie being the latest one. And it's really recognizing the partnership that really took place to protect and restore wetland communities that are really, really important to the state's citizens for not only recreation, but for a variety of other important values like water quality, flood control, and recharging our groundwater.
So let's talk a little bit more now about the Ramsar Convention and other significant places that it's working with and what it means.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Ramsar Convention is now well over 40 years old. It's a gathering of countries. Right now, about 170 countries have signed on to the treaty, recognizing the real value and the call for action needed to protect wetlands. And so in America, as Rob noted, there's 38 such sites that have received such significant designation. And in Wisconsin, what it means is we're really blessed with a great variety of conservation lands, from our great forest in the north to our shorelines on the Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, and habitat on the Mississippi River. But we also have a real blessed with a great number and variety of wetlands. In Wisconsin, the most significant sites recognized by RAMHSA are, as Rob and you mentioned, Door County, which was recently designated in May of this year, Horicon Marsh in Dodge County, the Kikagan and Bad River Sloughs on the Bad River Chippewa Reservation in Ashland County, and then the floodplain wetlands all along the Mississippi River, you know, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois.
So you mentioned the importance of wetlands. Why are wetlands important?
Well, as I noted earlier, wetlands provide incredible habitat for much of Wisconsin's wildlife. 75% of our wildlife, be it mammals, birds, toads, snakes, etc., really depend on wetlands for their lives. So they're essential for wildlife, but they're also really critical for the values that nature provides humans, such as filtering our water. Wetlands do an incredible job of filtering out sediment and nutrients such as phosphorus and nitrogen to give us clean drinking water or improved water for our rivers and lakes for recreation. They do just as great a job for flood control. They act as a sponge that really soaks up excess water during our storm events or during spring melt-offs from our long winters. And then finally, they allow a place in the landscape for water to recharge our aquifers, which again, we're really fortunate in Wisconsin to have such wetlands to provide the drinking waters that much of our state really depends on, that source of drinking water out of our ground.
Now, you mentioned the significance of this area. What does it look like if we were to go there and see it? What makes it so special?
Yeah, well, Chewaukee Prairie is located in the most southeastern part of our state. So it's bordered by Lake Michigan to its east and the border with the state of Illinois to the south. And it's a remnant. It's one of the last places of its type for a type of prairie that once existed from the city of Chicago northward up to the counties of Kenosha and Racine. It's a lake plain prairie, a prairie that has ridges of sand and swales of wetland all throughout it, paralleling the current coastline of Lake Michigan. And this prairie then, because it has these ridges as well as swales, has an exceptional diversity of plants and animals. One can find over 400 different kinds of plants at Chewaukee Prairie and the surrounding and the neighboring Lake Plain areas in Illinois. And these prairie plants then provide a diversity of habitats for a great diversity of birds, insects, and animals. And I finally want to mention, because of its location along Lake Michigan and its natural habitat of hundreds of acres in Wisconsin, over 500 acres, and then accompanying 3,000 acres in Illinois, it provides invaluable migratory bird stopover habitat, as birds are migrating up to Wisconsin and north in the springtime, and then back down south this time of year as the birds, they use the coastline as sort of a map, and they really depend and need places like Chewaukee Prairie that really provide, because it's in such a natural state, provide all of the wonderful niches and plant and animal matter for these birds to really rest and fuel up.
We're talking with Steve Richter right now from the Nature Conservancy. We're talking about the Chewaukee Prairie area receiving international designation now as a wetland of international importance. And Steve, what happens now that it has this designation? Does this mean that it will be set aside as a preserve in perpetuity?
It is. It is set aside in perpetuity as a natural area. And what it does is it just recognizes the great work of the partnership, especially the local people of Kenosha County, who 50 years ago this month really set course to try to protect this special place. And it's, so it's all about local people who care about a place, and they were motivated to action. And this recognition really, I guess, motivates all of the citizens of Wisconsin to carry forth that effort to continue to work of protecting the remaining lands that need to be protected and to continue the restoration work to maintain the and enhance the value of the preserve.
Is this going to change anything about how the land is managed going forward?
It is not. It's going to give just more attention to the restoration efforts, in particular maybe to really make sure that the groundwater and surface water that's so critical to maintaining the health of the prairie, that adequate supply is really thought about and maintained in the future. So I think that would be the one thing that this designation really will highlight is the need for all of the partners, including the communities that surround the prairie, to really make sure that the groundwater supply is there for not only the citizens, but it's also there for the natural area.
And Steve, as we wrap up, if we want to go take a look at this, visit, see the sites, where should we go and what should we be on the lookout for?
Well, again, you should go to the most southeastern corner of the state, Chewaukee Prairie. It's lands that the Nature Conservancy has most recently donated to the state of Wisconsin.
And is it earmarked with any signage or that kind of thing?
Yes, it is. It definitely is. There's signs, a kiosk, and there's old roadbeds and trails to hike on.
Excellent. Well, Steve, it sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Veronica, for the time. I appreciate it.
That was Steve Richter, Director of Conservation Programs for the Nature Conservancy. He joined us to talk about the Chewaukee Prairie area receiving international designation as a wetland of international importance.